Join left, right, and center host Bob Scheer for his new podcast, Scheer Intelligence. The twice-monthly podcast features thinkers and trendsetters in conversation with one of political journalism's leading voices. Through the show's unique and sometimes surprising perspectives, you'll get up to speed on the current issues shaping the Beltway and the world. Find Scheer Intelligence on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Tax avoidance, a global industry. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The leak of 11.5 million documents called the Panama Papers has revealed a vast, deeply rooted infrastructure for hiding money. Anybody can do it. Heads of states, investors, organized criminals, even professional wrestlers.
And here's the crazy part. Not pay taxes on any of it. It's called a shell company.
That is a lighthearted spoof by one of 100 news organizations with a story generating serious shockwaves all over the world. And the U.S. is a big part of the action. There are more shell companies in the state of Delaware than there are people. Today's talking point, virtual reality and full-body journalism. First, the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24, or you can listen on KCRW's app. Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Marvin Alney, back with To the Point. From Iceland to Beijing to Moscow, government leaders have tried to shrug off embarrassment from the so-called Panama Papers. We'll hear how the United States is also deeply involved in a worldwide web of tax havens for hiding trillions of dollars. Today's talking point, full-body journalism is the wave of the future for immersing the audience in the story. It's an application of virtual reality that is now accessible in your own home. First is news update. This year's Republican presidential campaign has set new standards for negative campaigning. Until now, the Democrats have been relatively constrained. But with the New York primary less than 2 weeks away, that's beginning to change. Jennifer Epstein is covering the campaign for Bloomberg. Good to have you with us.
Good to be on. Thanks.
This all began yesterday with the New York Daily News, published by, of course, a man who is in favor, who is a good friend of the Clintons, doing an interview with Bernie Sanders, where Bernie didn't seem to meet the standards that were required.
Yeah, he did this interview with the Daily News editorial board, which actually was conducted last Friday and has just kind of continued to get attention day after day, in which he didn't give all that many specifics when asked about his plans for Wall Street reform, specifically on breaking up the big banks, which has been a very central piece of his message throughout his campaign. And he also kind of stumbled on a couple of other answers about foreign policy, or just kind of said, I don't know. And he also said some stuff about guns and the fact that he doesn't believe that gun sellers should have legal liability. And all those things kind of added up to this interview that Clinton supporters immediately seized upon as one overall just kind of saying that it fits their narrative, that there's not really that much there. And two, that, you know, on guns in particular, that he's very insensitive to people, you know, victims of Sandy Hook shooting and so on. And so from there, you had Secretary Clinton go on Morning Joe yesterday morning, and there she was asked repeatedly by the host, Joe Scarborough, a former Republican congressman from Florida, is Senator Sanders qualified to be president?
Okay, let's get her response to that question from him. Here it is.
Well, I think the interview raised a lot of really serious questions. And I look at it this way. The core of his campaign has been break up the banks. And it didn't seem in reading his answers that he understood exactly how that would work under Dodd-Frank.
Jennifer Epstein, back to you. How did Bernie Sanders respond to that?
Well, he responded at a rally last night in Philadelphia by saying that Clinton had called him, quote unquote, and that's a quote from him, quote unquote, not qualified to be president, which was not something that she ever said. You know, she had intentionally, clearly avoided saying that. But he said she's not qualified, and then he listed reasons why, including that she's taking money from super PACs, that she supported many trade deals, and maybe biggest of all, that she voted for the Iraq war.
Okay, so wait a minute now. She did not say that he was unqualified, but he claims that is what she said. Here's a bit, again, of Bernie Sanders.
And she has been saying lately that she thinks that I am, quote-unquote, not qualified to be president. Well, let me just say in response to Secretary Clinton, I don't believe that she is qualified.
So, Jennifer Epstein, five reasons. What were they?
The five reasons were some of the things I was mentioning before, you know, supportive trade deals, taking money from super PACs and other large corporate donors, supporting the Iraq war, specifically supporting a trade deal with Panama. So these are all things that are, you know, well-known parts of her record. And he's basically saying because her views are not the same as his, she's not qualified to be president.
Okay, so all this goes to the issue of whether this late in the campaign there's going to be such a division between the two that whoever is ultimately nominated, the supporters of the other, might not be very enthusiastic about it.
Right. You know, this is a point in time when you at once see both candidates realizing, okay, we're down to the line. We need to do a lot. We need to, you know, for Sanders, who's behind it very much in the delegate count, to say, okay, I need to do something to jump out ahead, to catch up to her. And so he's on the attack a bit. But at the same time, you know, he kind of is not thinking as much about the long term, which is if he's not the nominee, it's going to be much harder to get his supporters on board with Secretary Clinton the more that he is disparaging her or saying that she's not qualified. And how does he walk that back when you get to the moment of unity that will probably come, you know, might not come until after the Democratic convention based on what the Sanders campaign is saying, but for that to come and is going to become more difficult if he keeps up this line. And you already saw Secretary Clinton today. She talked to reporters briefly before she rode the subway from Yankee Stadium for one stop. She said, you know, what matters to me is that we have to beat Ted Cruz or Donald Trump in the general election, and I'm not going to, you know, really comment on whether Senator Sanders is qualified.
And presumably she demonstrated that she knew how to use the subway. Jennifer Epstein, great to have you with us, a politics correspondent for Bloomberg. Thanks for joining us.
Bye.
In a moment, tax avoidance, a global industry. On To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Santa Monica-based public radio station KCRW relies on the support of its listeners. One way to help is by donating your old car, truck, boat, or motorcycle. We'll pick up the vehicle from anywhere in the country. Put your old ride to good use and take advantage of a great tax write-off. Visit kcrw.com/cars.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Mormon Olney back with To The Point. The leak of 11.5 million documents from a Panamanian law firm has caused embarrassment around the world. The Prime Minister of Iceland has resigned. Vladimir Putin has gone on TV to deny that his assets are hidden in a shell company owned by a friend. The President of China has demanded censorship of reporting on the Panama Papers, as they're called. 100 news organizations have access to the files, including including Fusion. That's a joint venture of ABC and Univision. Alice Brennan is an investigative reporter, and she's producer of an upcoming Fusion documentary called Dirty Little Secrets. Alice Brennan, great to have you.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
How did Fusion get on this list of 100 organizations?
Well, we've done a couple of projects with the ICIJ in the past, and they approached us in November last year and invited us to take part in the investigation. I think the reason being was that we present a very different perspective to this whole investigation. We appeal to a younger audience, and we break things down in simpler, more narrative terms than some of our other media partners. So it's been a pleasure to be aboard.
And the ICIJ is the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. What do you think is the main message of all of this, if there's one thing that you could single out?
Wow, that's a big question. in 11.5 million documents. Wow. The biggest message, I think, is the scope of this industry that many of us didn't even realize existed before this week. It's enormous. It's really revealing to see just how there's this whole population of people who are not playing by the same rules as you or I, and we have the documents to prove it. That's been the biggest revelation for me.
And when you say industry, describe that a little more. What do you mean by industry?
Well, as you know, Mossack Fonseca is a Panamanian law firm, but they're only one of about 10 similar firms around the world that offer similar services. They're a relatively boutique firm in Panama. We have the documents from this one firm, but it's only a drop in the ocean when you look at the scope and the scope of this industry. So, I mean, you've got lawyers, you've got registered agents, you've got people setting up incorporated entities all over the world who are part of this industry that, on one hand, is a perfectly legitimate industry, but it also serves very, very, very shady, shady, shady characters.
Now, there are a lot of people involved who are world leaders. I just mentioned a few are apparently involved. It's all very indirect because, of course, of the way these things are set up.
Yes, indeed. You've got Vladimir Putin. You've got relatives of Bashar al-Assad. You've got a lot of the Chinese, relatives of the Chinese ruling party. This goes far and wide.
Were there many Americans involved, many names that came up?
Relatively speaking, no. And that's been one of the questions that we've been continually asked over the last week is why aren't there more Americans in the file? And I can tell you we searched long and hard. But the very logical reason that there aren't more Americans in the files is that we don't need to go to Panama. America has been labeled the third largest tax haven in the world. We have states like Delaware, Nevada, and Wyoming that offer the same sort of secrecy, the same sort of services that one can get in Panama or any of these smaller island tax havens around the world. We don't need to go abroad.
Okay, we're going to come back to that, and we'll play a segment from your documentary, Dirty Little Secrets, which illustrates exactly what you're talking about. But first, I want to go to James Henry. He is a senior advisor to the Tax Justice Network. He's an investigative economist as well as a lawyer, author of many books on tax havens, including The Blood Bankers and Global Tax Fairness, and a book upcoming called Pirate Bankers. James Henry, good to have you on our program.
Good to be here.
We said earlier, we heard Alice Brennan say that many people, and I think she's absolutely right, didn't realize that this industry existed, but you did.
Well, unfortunately, I've been writing about this for 40 years, my first piece about the global haven industry and Panama and the role of U.S. As a tax haven was in the mid-80s for the New Republic and the Washington Post. So I've also estimated a couple years back that the global industry offshore is worth at least $21 to $32 trillion. Of financial wealth offshore, most of which is not taxed. So since I was investigating Noriega in 1987, when I first came across Mossack Fonseca, the number of havens has exploded from about 10 to 91. And it's become, as you say, an onshore industry in which you don't have to go to Panama. There's perfectly good financial secrecy in Delaware. But the point is that this one particular firm, Mossack, is one of a small handful of firms in Panama, but there's more than 500 banks around the world that have been channeling customers to them. And we're talking about the biggest banks in the world, HSBC, UBS, Credit Suisse, more than 15,000 companies at their behest. So this is really a global network of institutions, banks, law firms, accounting firms that are channeling business to tiny outfits like this. That's the real story here and the real problem with getting a handle on it. It's not just about tax either. I mean, in this case, we have the issue of kleptocracy. We have public officials who basically have been handing bribes or proceeds from the public treasury and concealing it offshore, a lot of which is just undeclared assets by public officials. The presumption is they're illegal. And we have sanction busting, trade with North Korea involved. If you imagine the Star Wars bar scene, you have this rogues gallery of tax dodgers, but also money launderers and drug dealers and arms dealers and kleptocrats sitting around using the same basic financial secrecy kind of institutions. And so the big picture is that, since the 1980s, this industry has grown up around the world. And it's really not a problem that just any one country like the United States could tackle on its own.
So we're talking about everybody ranging from organized criminals to well-established financial institutions to public officials.
Absolutely. I mean, we also quite a few celebrities have shown up here. But I think the real issue is that we have had really now decades, every decade, scandal after scandal involving offshore money. We've had the dictator, Obasa. We have the BCCI scandal. We had Salinas's accounts. We've had the Marcos money. Case after case, the journalists stand up and they say, the moral pedestal and denounce the latest revelation, and then nothing is done by government. So that is really the scandal here. And I hope now we're seeing the dam break on a global level. We can have an international commission with subpoena power to really investigate this. I mean, if Mossack Fonseca has, with 500 people and the $42 million of revenue every year in Panama has been up to this, think about Credit Suisse. They have 2 million clients in 41 countries and $1 trillion in assets under management. So, there is a huge industry here behind the scenes. And
that doesn't mean that all their clients are necessarily involved in offshore tax havens, does it?
No, absolutely not. And there is no way to know how much of this is actually illegal. All journalists can do here. And the whistleblowers involved here is to expose a little light on this subject. And then the prosecutors and the judiciary have to go over, insofar as there is effective prosecution for these institutions, and do their job, which is to see how much of this behavior is illegal. But there has to be a presumption that people who are going all the way to Panama to deal with this dodgy law firm that does handle all kinds of shady business. That's an expensive proposition. You don't do that hiding assets through BVI companies lightly.
Okay. Let me go back to – I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we'll come back to you in a moment, James Henry, with the Tax Justice Network. I want to go back to Alice Brennan because you did have a list, did you not, of some people who have set up shells through Mossack Fonseca who actually went to jail?
Yes, we have a list of, we have 22 people who have been through court cases in the United States, but we highlighted seven of them, amongst them an intermediary who was based in Malta. He was convicted of having 23 clients abusing the tax system, and he was ordered to pay $17.2 million in restitution and sent to jail. We've got Igor Alenikov, an accused Russian sex trafficker, convicted pedophile. He had offshore accounts through Mossack Fonseca as well. We had father and son Mauricio Cohen and Leon Cohen, who were developers here in Miami,
hiding $150 million in assets, and of also Marty Frankel, who you may know. But there's a whole list of Americans.
For those who don't, who's Marty Frankel?
Marty Frankel was he was convicted of looting $200 million of insurance companies' assets and diverting them into his own private offshore accounts. And he had quite the lavish lifestyle before he was sentenced to 17 years in jail in 2004.
All right. We're going to get back once again to the involvement of American companies and American law in all of this. But first, I want to look at another aspect of it. With Sarah Chase. She is a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. She lived in Kandahar in Afghanistan for the better part of the last decade. She's a former special advisor to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and she's author of Thieves of State, Why Corruption Threatens Global Security. Sarah Chase, welcome back to our program.
Great to be here, Warren.
Based on what we've already heard from our other guests, tell us about the relationship that you have made between this kind of corruption and global security.
Well, and I'd just like to pause for a second on the linkage you just made. Organized criminals, well-respected financial institutions, and government officials. And that really is the nature of kleptocracy, a word that we've also just heard. And I think that's a really important thing to come out of this, is just as this type of law firm and the services it provides is a network, kleptocracies really are integrated networks of those three groups that you just mentioned: organized criminals, government officials, and well-respected private sector actors, be they construction companies or banks or whatever. And that's part of why getting at this type of abuse is so difficult, because it reaches, as we're seeing, all the way back to the United States, where even though there may not be many Americans named in this trove of documents, this is just the intermediary. In other words, the companies created by Mossack and Fonseca, I haven't looked at the documents, but I would be shocked if none of them have bought either real estate or put money into the United States. So we are, the West is providing corruption services, if you will, often via offshore intermediaries like Mossack and Fonseca, to some of the famous corrupt countries in the world or corrupt government officials in the world. And that means that U.S. economy and politics are predicated to some extent on this business model, too. And that may explain the lag in changing some of the U.S. regulations about, banking secrecy and beneficial ownership of shell companies. How this impacts security is that the government officials who may use a company like Mossack and Fonseca to extract money that they have gotten via very illicit and abusive practices in their own country. And that means shakedowns that add up to billions of dollars literally per year, even in a country like Afghanistan. It means unfairly capturing public procurement. So you've got, something like the Ministry of, it's called Emergency Situations in a Central Asian country, is providing, the infrastructure building contracts to companies that belong to the ruler of that country's daughters or wife. Right?
And when you were in Afghanistan, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but when you were in Afghanistan, did you see American tax money that was supposed to be devoted to one particular purpose go to something else?
Well, it's that it gets captured by the government, and so from the perspective, by the government for personal gain. And so from the perspective of the population, what's happening is they're being ruled by a mafia. The U.S. government, either directly, as you suggest, or indirectly via these type of banks or real estate purchases, is in fact reinforcing and enabling the corrupt capture of the entire economy of a country. And so people get desperate because, oh, by the way, a kleptocratic government will also capture the judiciary, so there's no recourse. And desperate people will turn to extreme responses. And we've been seeing these extreme responses in the last 10 okay. years, from terrorism to the revolutions of the Arab Spring in Ukraine and to other types of extreme responses.
All right. We need to go to a break. We'll come back. We've been talking with Sarah Chayes, again, former advisor to the Joint Chiefs of Staff. We'll find out about their interest, and we'll also hear more about how you can go about setting up a company here in the United States of the kind that we are talking about. On our talking point later, virtual reality and full-body journalism. We'll find out what that is and talk to a pioneer. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Check out KCRW's music blog for song premieres, music news, performances, and KCRW DJ features. Stay up to date on all of KCRW's music happenings at kcrw.com/musicblog.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. The Panama Papers, so-called, 11.5 million documents leaked from the Mossack Fonseca attorney's office in Panama have revealed a great, well, given sort of a peek, I guess, is the best way to put it, into an industry that may be worth $32 trillion, according to one of our guests, at least comparable to the national debt of the United States. And it goes all the way from organized crime, if we've heard, to government officials, to major financial institutions, and constitutes a real threat to international security. So let's take a look at how easy it is to set up a tax shelter in the state of Delaware. Alice Brennan, back to you with Fusion. I want to play a little bit of one of your documentary segments, Dirty Little Secrets. Here it is. A Fusion reporter visits an agent that sets up these companies.
I've never done this before. I'd like to set up this company for my cat. I have a cat named Suki. Actually, I have a photo of her right here.
She's adorable.
Isn't she cute?
Yes.
So the company I'd like to set up is called She Sells Seashells, LLC.
Catchy title, says the agent. Alice Brennan, back to you. Set up a company in the name of a cat, and that sounds just fine to the agents involved in Delaware. You have that little music playing in the background there, as if this is just business as usual.
It was just business as usual. We tried to stretch it as far as we could in that interview. We went in there and we said, we'd like to set up a shell company, and then we'd like to set up a shell company in our friend's name, and then we'd like to set up a shell company. Actually, no, we'd like it for our cat. And as we went through the process, we offered a number of times different forms of identification, and they didn't need anything, driver's license, gym membership, library card, nothing. And the whole thing was done in 5 minutes. But if you did it over the internet, it would take maybe 1 to 2 minutes. So it's pretty incredible.
One of the things you report is that there are more companies of this kind in the state of Delaware than there are people.
Right. And they make an incredible amount of money from it, $1.2 billion
$1 a year, according to Delaware's Chief Deputy Secretary of State there. They make, I think it's about one-fifth of the state's revenue comes from company formation. So they obviously have good reason to place a great emphasis on this industry because it brings them cash.
Now, are the people who involved, the ones there who were so happy to set up the corporation in the name of the cat, we never did hear the cat's name, but apparently it was an attractive cat, according to the picture. Are they responsible in any way for what these companies ultimately do?
Well, that was one of the interesting things that came out of the interview, and it's been one of the really interesting parts of our research project and the process of researching this. I wasn't at all familiar with the industry before we came on board, which is that at every step along the way, no one feels a sense of responsibility for what these companies are doing. So you ask the incorporation agents and they say, well, if somebody brings it to our attention, of course we'll strike them off our books. And then we ask, how would you know if somebody's doing something untoward with their company? And they responded with, well, we don't know. We have no idea. In fact, while we were at the incorporation agent's office in Delaware, they were served with a subpoena for a company based in Mexico. All they need for you to incorporate a company with them is a living, breathing point of contact. It doesn't have to be the beneficial owner. And for me, that goes to the core of this story, the core of the issue. Number one, that nobody feels responsibility for what these companies are doing. And number two, there's often no way of tracing the actual origin of these companies. You don't know who the beneficial owner is.
And the people were served by with a subpoena, but they weren't held accountable in any way.
We don't know. We're not sure. Nancy went in to check and to see if they were still on their books, and yes, they were. And she said what she would do is she'd take the subpoena and she would then send it to her point of contact. So that may very well be a mail drop in Panama. It may very well be a post box in Wyoming, and it may end there. She didn't know.
Let me go back to James Henry, again, our senior advisor to the Tax Justice Network. He started writing about this in the mid-'80s. Not just Delaware, but also Nevada and Wyoming are involved in this.
There's actually 49 U.S. states that offer LLCs, none of which require so-called beneficial ownership registration. And 13 of them have now begun to offer so-called asset protection trusts, which are another layer of financial secrecy, modeled on the Cook Islands, which is a notorious place. If you want to defraud creditors, you can go to Nevada now and have a trust set up that only has a 2-year look back. So it really has become pervasive. But I think the key point to remember here is that, yes, the U.S. is a tax haven, but most of the kleptocrats here that we're talking about in the Panama thing are going through BVI. They're going to Panama because Putin's not going to put his money in Delaware. The Chinese oligarchy is not either. And so there is a lot of work for the U.S. to do in terms of cleaning this mess up. But I think we really have to remember that there is a whole global industry involved in this, in creating it and in profiting from it. It's at that level of international cooperation that a lot of work has to be done here.
And what does BVI stand for?
British Virgin Islands. It accounts for half of the companies that were set up by Mossack Fonseca. They have about a million companies registered there, and 100,000 of them came from Mossack Fonseca. So we know there are a lot of other players like Mossack involved. About a third of those companies came from China. So this is, again, a global industry. And the other great point about this, I think it's important for journalists and whistleblowers to remember, is that we have not had a whistleblower-friendly administration under Obama. This whole expose, it's groups like Fusion, the International Consortium. It wasn't law enforcement. It wasn't the NSA. It wasn't government that brought this to light. The way we really go forward here is to have much more support for whistleblowers and for journalism around the world.
Very quickly, you say that they might not want to park, the international players might not want to park their money in Delaware, but they certainly might want to buy real estate in New York, might they not?
Oh, yeah, and there's a lot of offshore companies that have put money in New York, and many of them come from Russia. But much of London is owned by Russians, you know, the 90,000 Russians living in city of London that's called Moscow on the Thames, and they're using offshore companies as well. So it's really the financial capitals of the world that have become the destination havens, if you will. Nobody puts their money in Panama. It's all being routed back through these offshore companies back into the first world banks and investment organizations. That's one of the reasons there is so much hypocrisy here with respect to the OECD countries trying to clean this up.
James Henry, again with the Tax Justice Network. Sarah Che, Senior Associate, Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, lived in Kandahar, Afghanistan for most of the last decades, former Special Advisor to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, author of Thieves of State, Why Corruption Threatens Global Security. What about the American military and the Joint Chiefs of Staff? Is there, when you talk about connecting this to security and the name of your book, Why Corruption Threatens Global Security, is the military worried about it?
Really interesting question. I mean, what I found in the Afghanistan experience was the military was becoming alert to it in a way that U.S. civilian leadership was not. And that was partly because, you know, being deployed on the ground, they became, you know, military commanders became aware of what a complete obstacle, let's say, a governor was who was, you know, shaking down, you know, the members of the population and, in a sense, driving people into the arms of the Taliban. And so I wouldn't say the military took it on board wholeheartedly, but at least became ambivalent about the issue, whereas at that time, U.S. State Department, even the civilian leadership in the Defense Department, and so when I say military, I mean uniform military, and certainly folks like the CIA were not interested in this issue whatsoever. I think that's started to change. Partly because of the just current events. After the Arab Spring, you had Ukraine, you've had Nigeria, you have revelations like this. It's really hard to miss the impact of corruption on security. And so recently at Davos, Secretary of State John Kerry did make a pretty strong statement linking corruption to security crises. The problem is that when the U.S. government is up against a hot security crisis, that kind of trumps, if you will, every other consideration, even corruption. And so there sort of isn't time for people to take a step back and say, whoa, what is the underlying driver of this security crisis? And so then you get this trade-off where it's like, oh, we have to work with Uganda. Oh, we have to work with Kenya. Oh, we have to work with, you know, Honduras, because the government is helping us with whatever the security crisis might be, whether it's migrants out of Honduras or whether it's, you know, terrorism issues in, you know, further to the east. And the problem is that's an incredibly self-defeating approach. And that approach is not just the fault of the military. It's that civilians are still throwing the military at a lot of these problems that are fundamentally have their roots in the type of kleptocracy we've been discussing today.
Is it possible that the Taliban or ISIS even might in fact be involved in this international system of corruption?
I have no doubt. I would not be at all surprised if that were the case. It would be indirectly because, of course, this, as much as this is about secrecy, it does leave some type of records. I wouldn't be surprised. But I don't actually see that as the fundamental security implication of this. That's a sort of how does a Mossack and Fonseca help facilitate, you know, terrorist activities.
Okay.
I think the deeper problem is that the governmental abuse that it facilitates and that it links the West to drives indignant people into the arms of extremists as an only way of getting kind of revenge.
Okay. James Henry, back to this country in 5 minutes to set up a corporation in Delaware that doesn't even require an ID. Have there been efforts to reform the laws of Delaware and Wyoming and now you say 49 other states that want to get in on the action?
Well, as a powerful lobby in Washington fighting all that, the Obama administration just this week has adopted new regulations for not only for corporate inversions, but also for banks, requiring them to know the beneficial owners, even if they have companies. So, but this is really very late in the day. You know, the United States still has tax laws that make non-resident aliens, so-called, who invest in U.S. stocks and bonds and bank accounts basically tax-free on their capital income. That goes back to the 60s and 70s. We've had this financial secrecy network kind of growing up since then. So, you know, there is powerful resistance. You mentioned the fact that Delaware derives at least 20% of their income, the state of Delaware, from corporate registries. This is a big business. There's 1,800 tax lobbyists in Washington, and they're not working for you and me. But there are some relatively straightforward things we could do. We could have beneficial ownership registration. We could have public officials required to declare their onshore and offshore wealth. We could crack down on banks and the other enablers and make sure that there's stiffer regulations and penalties. We could try blacklisting havens, except for our own states, perhaps. I think the national security issue is a powerful one as well. And the fundamental point there is we have had a history of turning a blind eye to dictators like Marcos in the Philippines, Suharto, Pinochet, who were aggressive users of the international haven industry. But we always put the priority on the short-term sort of perceived security interests. And in the long term, we end up with an active resistance movement in the Philippines. We have had instability in Indonesia as well. We have, you know, turning a blind eye to this kind of corruption behavior and the offshore industry's role in it has really not served our national security interests well at all.
All right, so, just as we heard from Sarah Chase. Alice Brennan, back to you. Again, 11.5 million documents. You haven't looked at them all. But did you see any evidence that there is interest on the part of various officials, other than former Senator Carl Levin, in trying to reform the situation, at least make sure that the banks know who they're dealing with?
Yeah, there is obviously he was waving the flag in a big way, and he's recently retired, but there are people stepping in behind him. There was legislation that was, it passed somewhere recently in the last couple of months, and there are people working behind the scenes all the time. We also spoke to the FBI, and they were very, very open about how they've been pushing legislators to have an open register of beneficial ownership, because in many, many cases it impedes their investigations. So I think there is movement, but I agree with James in that let's hope that the international the international community gets together and does something internationally, because I don't think it's just an American problem or just a Panamanian problem. Again, it's this idea of a global network, and as soon as you have one leak in the bucket, out comes all of the water.
Sarah Chase, 30 seconds left. What about James Henry's suggestion that there be an international commission with subpoena power to do something about that? Is there any prospect of that?
I think there are a lot of discussions underway at the moment of some type of an international approach to some of this. It's still quite rudimentary. People have talked about potentially an anti-corruption court, and then, you know, it might have such investigatory powers. But I think that's a while off.
Thank you all for giving us a wealth of information about all of this. Sarah Chase, again, with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Her book, Thieves of State, Why Corruption Threatens Global Security. James Henry with the Tax Justice Network, investigative economist and lawyer, author of The Blood Bankers, Global Tax Fairness, and a book upcoming, Pirate Bankers. And Alice Brennan with Fusion, soon to come out, Dirty Little Secrets, a documentary on the tax havens. We heard a bit of it on our program. Thank you all very much for being on our show today. Last week, Facebook's Oculus Rift began shipping headsets to customers, but virtual reality is about a lot more than just entertainment. Back in a moment with today's talking point.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Listen to the Rhythm Planet podcast to explore music from all corners of the globe. Brazilian, European, African, and tropical Latin. Rhythm Planet is a state of mind. Listen at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet or on KCRW's app.
Warren Alney here with today's talking point. Virtual reality has gone way beyond gamers. The New York Times, the Des Moines Register, Frontline, and KCRW are among the media organizations that use it. Noni de la Peña debuted Project Syria at the World Economic Forum in Davos. It's a full-body experience that puts viewers at the scene of a bombing and then allows exploration of a refugee camp. Noni de la Peña works at USC's School of Cinematic Arts. She's co-founder of the Emblematic Group, and she joins us here in the studio at KCRW in Santa Monica. Good to have you.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Tell us what this is. What do you mean by full-body experience?
So the mind is surprisingly plastic, and when you put on goggles and you've got good audio and then you're tracked so that you can walk around, you feel like your whole body has gone to this other place. You haven't forgotten that you're here. It's something I call duality of presence. You know you're still here, but you feel like you're there also. And a full-bodied experience is exactly that. You walk around with your full body instead of just looking at a 2D image.
So you put on these goggles, just for those who haven't had a chance to do that, and you do have a 360-degree experience. You can turn around, and the picture continues, and you can see what's behind you.
And it's even more than just looking around. It also means that you can walk around. So just like in the real world, what you see, what's around you, when you know, you can bend, jump, turn, whatever, that corresponds in the virtual world, that sort of shift. And that's what makes your mind feel like you're actually there.
Okay, it's a lot of fun. It's great for games. You can do it with artwork and things of that kind. Why journalism? How does it apply?
So, as you know, my background was I was a correspondent for Newsweek. I made documentary films. And I was always driven to tell compelling stories. So what do you do? How do you get people to really understand important subject matter? I felt like virtual reality was an unusual medium that by putting people on scene, they could have a more visceral connection to the story and understand something quickly and deeply.
Do you get into the same kinds of problems, though, that you would with the body cams for the police, for example? Is there a possibility of distorting reality when you're trying to record it?
So I think that you definitely always have those kind of challenges, right? We know that every medium, right? Print, radio, any kind of broadcast. As journalists, we have to approach things with some sort of ethical underlying, you know, concepts. I think we've always had to knock on that. You take, for example, most recently when Mosley died, who killed Kitty Genovese, how interesting that it turned out that that reporting on text actually got it wrong, that there were people who tried to help. And it established this whole way of thinking. So it doesn't really matter what medium you're working in. As journalists, we have to take our job very seriously and approach things ethically.
Describe a little more in more detail than I was able to do what the Syria Project shows.
So the Syria Project takes you to the street in a day when a bomb goes off in Aleppo and a young girl is singing. And suddenly everything's, you know, turned into a chaotic, crazy atmosphere. We had access to the original video of this little girl singing, but we also had to collect aftermath content, aftermath audio. And I also sent a team to the border of Syria and Iraq. Now, this is a few years ago, became a very ISIS stronghold, and I wouldn't necessarily send a team there now. But that's where recorded material in refugee camps and particularly with young children and seeing how their lives had been completely upturned.
So when you went to the scene in Syria, did you have cameras surrounding you? Did you have a 360-degree camera, and then you have to coordinate that with the audio?
So in this case, no, because when I made Project Syria, we really didn't have any GoPro 360 rigs even to capture with. What we did is we used photographs, video, and audio, and then we reconstructed it digitally. Moreover, with 360 video, right now, currently, we're only just getting to be able to make content that you can shoot and walk around. 360 video still keeps you in your seat. It's still a 2D rendition in a 360-degree way. In order to have it change in what's called real time, you have to render it in such a way that the computer knows to change the view with depth anywhere you look.
Tell us about the reconstructions that you have done for other projects, such as the one that shows a domestic violence case with the police responding.
So in that piece, what we did is we took two 911 calls from two sisters who were trying unsuccessfully, unfortunately, to rescue a third sister from a fatal attack by an ex-boyfriend. And because the sisters are in and out of the house where their third sister is being held hostage, we were able to take you in and out of the locations. Now, we built that completely digitally. It had to be recreated digitally. But we used FOIA gathered material. We used interviews with the sisters. We used police reports. We used photographs to try to make sure we reproduce the scenario as accurately as we possibly could. And it's a, I would suggest it's a pretty powerful piece. It's had extraordinary reviews, and it makes you feel like you're on scene at this, you know, otherwise it's very almost flat statistic that three women a day are killed by their intimate partners. But by being in this room with these sisters desperately trying to rescue the third sister, you really understand the story in a much more visceral way.
And you built that from the reality of the 911 calls. You started with the audio and then made it a 360-degree video.
That's correct. We absolutely had to build this based on the audio because there was no images of what really happened. Again, we try to craft it with the best journalistic integrity that we can. But, you know, some of the pieces, of course, are recreation. So, you know, there's always a, like, how do we approach that? And there's some pushback about that, certainly at this point. But as we move into something called videogrammetry, where we capture in 3D, but with video, we're going to see a very interesting new techniques of journalistic practice.
Obviously, empathy is one of the things that develops from this when you experience something in the way that you do when you see it in a three-dimensional way. Is it useful or would it be useful not just for journalism but for advocacy?
I think that we're going to see all kinds of things happening in this field. We're going to see education. We're going to see – we built a giant heart, one-to-one life-size heart, and you can use the controllers and touch the heart, and it starts to beat. And boy, do you understand the size and dimension and proportions of a heart in a way that I don't think I ever have in any other medium. You're going to see it be used for propaganda. Every medium historically always has, whether it was a poster, whether it was a film, like in the, you know, the Hitler's crazy film in the Nazi camps. So the real question is then, how do we give our audience critical thinking about the medium and make sure they understand when to look at something and accept its veracity and when to question, you know, what's being what they're experiencing?
Are you concerned about that? Are you concerned that it might be misused or used in an irresponsible way? There's really no way to control that, is there?
Absolutely no way to control it. It's really only, again, about how do we teach our audience to have some critical thinking about what they're experiencing.
So what would be the cues? What would you want people to start out with as they look at this for the first time?
So I think when you talk about news organizations or news material in particular, you have to put your trust in organizations that have been trustworthy previously, like the New York Times. We built KIA in collaboration with Al Jazeera America.
KIA is the domestic abuse or murder story. Go ahead.
We're working with Fusion. So we have a number of organizations that have been known to be trustworthy. And I think you need to start there. But as the medium develops, what is going to be the very interesting question is transparency, right? We know now with web-based content, you can click through pretty quickly and look where source documents are. And I think that's going to be the challenge as somebody who cares deeply that my audience understands that there's veracity in a story, how do I offer them the techniques to research it themselves?
Okay, and it is already here. We are not talking about the future. Noni de la Peña, once again, the journalist, co-founder of Emblematic Group, producing a virtual reality in three dimensions. Thank you so much for being on our program.
I really appreciate the time of being here.
I'm Marwan Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.